This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Carl Davidson, one of the old leaders of the SDS back in the 60s and 70s, and now he's national co-chair and field organizer of the Committee of Correspondents for Democracy and Socialism. Carl Davidson, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Give me a sense. I haven't met you before, unless my memory is just totally dead, where you came from, how you got interested in politics in the first place.
Now, that's an interesting question. I'm a Western Pennsylvania hillbilly by a background. I was a working class greaser who lucked his way into college back in the early 60s and was enamored by, you know, rockabilly and James Dean and Elvis Presley and the Beat Generation and all of that stuff. I was an alienated hillbilly. And when I got to university, around about there, I crossed the color line and got into jazz music and things like that.
Were you a musician yourself? Did you play
music?
No,
I just loved it. And so when I saw, you know, police dogs being turned on young black kids, and I had a number of black friends who I hung out with at these different venues, jazz. I sort of took it personally, and I was one of the young kids who started, a Francis Nick chapter at Penn State, and also a peace group, the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had compulsory ROTC back then, and I was the first kid to refuse to take ROTC.
What was the consequence of that? Were you disciplined or something?
They actually didn't know what to do with me. I wasn't a Quaker. And so finally, they took me up, and I sat down and had a meeting with the president of the university, and he decided that I was sincere, and so they eventually gave me a conscientious objector status to ROTC. So I won my case.
So you were involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and then how'd you get involved in SDS?
I had gone to the March on Washington in April 1965. And just before then, an SDS organizer had come through town and convinced me that the SDS was the new reincarnation of the Wobblies, which sort of captured my romanticism at the time. And I went to Washington and fell in love with the organization. And the following year, I had moved to Nebraska. I had gotten a job as an instructor in philosophy and doing work on doing graduate work. And so we started an SDS chapter at the University of Nebraska. Then I became Great Plains regional organizer. Then I went to Mississippi, which was really the...
What was that like?
That was changed my life. I went on a march against fear, and we walked 250 miles from Memphis to Jackson.
What year is this?
1966. And it was the year, on that march is when Stokely Carmichael launched the Black Power slogan. I was sitting out in a little black church full of sharecroppers when he did it, and the air just turned electric, you know. So when I came back from that, I said, well, black power for black people, worker power for workers, student power for students, we got to spread this around. So I wrote a paper on it about student syndicalism and ended up at the Clear Lake Convention. And next thing I knew, I was a national officer of the organization. Totally unexpected. But anyway, that's how it happened.
What's the legacy, Carl Davidson, of SDS, do you think?
I think the most important thing is students are a constituency in their own right. They're a social sector of society. I think before then, in the 30s and before, students were basically seen as intellectuals who were an ally. You could become an ally of the working class or a supporter of the working class by joining a left organization. But I think, you know, we were the ones who saw that students and youth were a mass new constituency, the trainees of a new working class. And that was an analysis we developed, and I think that's probably the most lasting thing that I contributed.
You know, I was in Chile last year, and the students there are a real critical force. They were out on strike for almost a year. They've been campaigning countrywide for free college education, among other things, as well as a total renunciation of the Pinochet social regime that he set up. Student activism in the U.S. Is less so these days than it was when you were around, obviously, in the SDS, and also than it is in other places like Spain and Greece and Chile. How do you assess it? I mean, there is Occupy going on, after
right. Well, the first thing I think is students have a very different situation than when I was young. We were the baby boom. There was a huge number of us, number one. But when I went to Penn State, my tuition was $1,500 a year. I had a $1,000 a year loan. I got a job as a janitor to make up the rest. If I needed a few hundred bucks, my dad made it at the track and helped me out. Nobody's mortgage was at stake if I skipped out of school for a year and ran around the country organizing against the war. I can't imagine the burden that these young kids are under today. Or even if they, you know, don't do anything and they get out, they have $50,000. They have equivalent of mortgage and new house on their back before they've even gotten a job.
Well, how do we get back to a free public college education?
We have to fight for it. You know, it's actually very much in the American tradition. You know, one of the smartest things the country ever did was at the end of World War II was the GI Bill. They threw money at all these unemployed workers and told them, go to school. I paid for them to go to school. And we're still benefiting from that move. But somewhere along the line, we started seeing students as consumers of wealth rather than as producers of new wealth. My view is that students are producers of new wealth, mainly in their own skills, their own human and social capital, and the country should subsidize it. You can make students pay something, a small amount, but you know, more or less like the way it was when I went to State University.
Well, with student debt so high, I would think that this would be a popular movement emanating from the students' direct experience.
I think so. And I think it's coming up more and more frequently in the discussions around Occupy Wall Street. If you look at all the different journals that the Occupy kids are putting out, you know, different radical left groups or anarchist, even the anarchist groups, every one of them has an article on the crushing burden of student debt and debt peonage and things like this. To the students' credit, I think while this motivated them, they very quickly took up much wider issues. They weren't just fighting for themselves. But I think in a way, you can see the Occupy Wall Street movement as a kind of first rebellion of the new working class that we talked about back in the 1960s. These are kids that are university trained. They want to enter the workforce, but there's no spots for them. I've got a couple of nephews and nieces. They've got college degrees, and the best jobs they can get are their waitresses and restaurants or waiters and bars and things like that.
Where do you see Occupy Wall Street going?
I think it's going to divide into two, to be frank. And it's going to divide... Hopefully, it'll divide between the black bloc types who think, you know, the revolutionary consciousness is built by the sounds of tinkling glass, and everybody else. I've always seen it in two ways. One, the first thing they did right was to rebel. The second was that they picked the right target, Wall Street. And I saw them as sort of a critical force or a militant minority of a popular front against finance capital. And it's very important for them to form wider alliances. And those possibilities have opened up very quickly. I know Trumka from the AFL-CIO is very quick to jump on it. In Pittsburgh, where I'm from, Leo Girard from the Steelworkers very quickly mobilized 5,000 workers to support the first day of Occupy Pittsburgh. And I think that it's critical for them to maintain. They're the militant minority. They're the critical force. But when all is said and done, they're not the main force. And so they have to treasure and, you know, grow those alliances with the main force.
I'm speaking with Carl Davidson. He was one of the old leaders of SDS, actually vice president and national secretary from 1968 to 1976. He's now national co-chair and field organizer of the Committee of Correspondents for Democracy and Socialism. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. I wanted to pick up something about, you know, you talked about the black bloc here, and that brought back images in my head of the Weather Underground. You saw how left-wing social movement and protest movement can turn violent and what the consequences can be. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, a lot of the Weather Underground people were my very good friends. And some of the people who died in the townhouse bombing were one of them was a former roommate of mine. I fought them very early on, back when it counted. I was in a faction that opposed them. And so I know the Weather Underground well, and I know how destructive it can be. One of the more interesting books I read recently was by a guy named John Satomoto. It's called The Postmodern Prince. And it's a study of Gramsci, where he takes Gramsci and applies him to everything since 1968, going forward. And he makes a very interesting point in this book. He says, since 1968, all politics can be put in two boxes. One is politics as self-expression. The other is politics as strategy. So I think that's exactly right. You have politics as self-expression. That's the black bloc. Not only the black bloc. There's a lot of people in that. The main thing is the politics way of expressing your own subjectivity and putting it forward in a militant way. And the other politics of strategy is starts with asking the question, who are your friends? Who are your enemies? Learning how to count and forming alliances with people you don't agree with. In order to bring about real change, you have to combine both. You need the audacity of the politics of self-expression, but you need the cold calculation and building up the relationship of forces that come with the politics of strategy in order to utterly isolate your real adversaries. So that's, I think, a lesson that we learned the hard way, in the sense that SAS was defeated because we couldn't handle the question of politics. The Weather Underground was the politics of self-expression on steroids. And the politics of self-expression of a bunch of spoiled rich kids, to tell you the truth, who were so alienated from the culture that they had nothing to stand on. They couldn't even stand on the America of popular democracy. To see their roots, they saw themselves as an alien fifth column and ended up self-destructing. The Black Bloc, borrows a lot from that tradition. I think that, the rest of Occupy will have to isolate it and move on to a more positive orientation that I talked about earlier, that when all is said and done, they are the critical force. They hold up a mirror to society. This is what you become to. But when all is said and done, they're not the main force. They have to form an alliance with the main force. Because in the end, it's people in their millions that make history, not just the militant minority.
Speaking with Carl Davidson, formerly of the SDS back in the 60s and 70s, he's now national co-chair and field organizer of the Committee of Correspondents for Democracy and Socialism. Tell me about that.
CCDS, to use the shorthand, I hate the name. The only reason I put up with the name is hopefully that we could eventually merge with some other groups and form something bigger and better. But it started as a split off the Communist Party. They rebelled over, the Gorbachev question and 21st century socialism issues and internal democracy in the old Communist Party. And I had always been on the outside of it. I was the one who went through the whole Maoist trip for a period. I was a member of a different Maoist organizations. But every time I went to China, the Chinese would always ask us about the American Communist Party, and they'd always say the same thing. The vast majority of the members of the Communist Party are good people. So I sort of took this to heart, and I learned. I became good friends with people like Gil Green and a few other, Jack Spiegel and a few other guys that I liked. I never cared for, Gus and his crew.
That'd be Gus Hall.
Right, Gus Hall. But so finally, when all the people that I really liked in the party rebelled and split, I figured, well, this is something I've got to relate to. So I went to their first conference, and I was amazed that I was the youngest person there, and I was 50. So I felt, well, there's 100 years of knowledge in this room. There were about 2,000 people there. And the whole history of American radicalism, or at least big chunks of it, are in this room. And this is a valuable resource. And the problem is it has to be connected with a new generation, because revolutions in the end are made by the young. They're made by people from 20 to 40 of different classes. But, you know, even the Wobblies were basically a young movement of kids in their 20s. That's, you know, I joined them because I told them, I said, well, if I join you, I said, you're going to have to put up with me. First thing I'm going to do is organize my own faction. They said, that's fine. We're multi-tendency. I said, well, good, okay. I'll go for that. And so I worked with it for a number of years. And then finally, when it came time for me to retire from the work I was doing in Chicago, they asked me to be a co-chair. I said, well, on one condition, that you also make me a field organizer and support it. And we'll see if we can save this organization and make some connections with the new generation of young people coming up. So I like CCDS because it does allow a certain diversity of thinking. We have people in the Green Party. We have people in the who work with the Progressive Democrats of America. We have people who are in Peace and Freedom Party. And we continue that perennial argument in the left inside our own organization. But so anyway, I'm giving it its last best shot to see what we can do with it.
And it's the last best shot for what exactly?
I think we have to build a much broader left. I think we have to build some, you know, the things I have in my mind, even though I understand the conditions are very different, are like Die Linke in Germany or the Left Front, the Front de Gauche in France, where a number of different tendencies can come together around the practical platform of the day, but with the kind of critical mass so you can make a difference. We've had a few things like that happen here, I think, on a very small scale. I think Dan Labatz ran an interesting campaign in Ohio for senator a couple of years back, which is something I'd like to see repeated elsewhere. But instead of just one group doing it, I'd like to see, you know, half a dozen left groups get behind it. And so we can have a little more critical mass and see what we can do with it. Because it's one thing to, you know, vote practically and, you know, stop and defeat certain candidates or, you know, get a lesser evil elected. But in the long run, we really have to think about the future. We have to realize that we have to build a socialist, a viable, broad, dynamic socialist movement if we're really going to get at the root of the problems the country faces.
And do you think that the term socialism is a viable one after the Soviet Union example?
I think we can rescue it. I think that I always use the phrase 21st century socialism, assuming that there's a difference, implying that there's an important difference between the centrism, the socialism of a new century and the one that went before. And I've put up on, if people want to Google it, I've put up 11 talking points on 21st century socialism. You can find it under just Googling it in my name.
It's Carl Davidson.
Right. And I think, you know, the three key things that are distinctive is one, a new socialism understands and appreciates the role of markets. It understands and appreciates the role of human rights. And it understands and appreciates that all economies are subsets of an ecosystem. So there's probably more to 21st century socialism than that, but if I had to boil it down to 3 points, I think those are important ones.
Now, here in the U.S., I saw a poll that showed that young people, I think under 30, had a positive attitude toward socialism.
Actually, yeah, 36% of them, to be precise.
I mean, that was a kind of a shocking figure, wasn't it?
It was, in the sense that, you know, I would have, if somebody had asked me off the top of my head, I would have said 20%, you know. I knew that a lot of people were open to it, but 36% sounded good. I knew from working among the blue-collar older workers in Western Pennsylvania, a lot of them would come up to me and say, you know, they would hear the right-wing's attack on Obama for being a socialist. And I said, Davidson, what is this socialism? You're a socialist. Tell us about socialism. So we organized study groups, and we used some modern books. I like David Schweikert's book, you know, After Capitalism is the one I use for these kind of study groups. And people loved it. And they're very open to it once you break it down and explain it. More realistic idea of what economic democracy looks like as a bridge to a new socialist order. That we respect human rights, we like the Bill of Rights, we see that the powers of socialist government have to be limited by natural human right. And if you frame things and package it in terms that people understand in their own realities and their own traditions, you can find a great deal of support for socialism. It's still a minority trend in the U.S. It's still a militant minority, but it's much larger than people might think. But right now, I've got, you know, there's too many lone rangers out there. You can't really be a socialist by yourself, you know. It's no fun, number one, and it's not very effective. So for every socialist who's in an organization, there's 99 more who've yet to be organized. So that's really the challenge we face.
And how do you get them? How do you organize them?
The old-fashioned way. You got to knock on doors and talk to people. I mean, Facebook is great, and, you know, email's fine. I have email lists of, you know, thousands of socialists. But you really have to get people the old-fashioned way. You have to sit down, and you have to get them to pull out their checkbook and pay their dues.
You know, I want to ask you a question. I'm in Madison, Wisconsin here. We had an uprising.
Yes, you did.
Very inspiring uprising in 2011. And we had 100,000 people in the streets. And it seemed to me that the heads of the state labor organization didn't know what to do with 100,000 people in the street. They were confused. They were actually, I think, bewildered and maybe scared of where this group may go without them or with them behind them. And I just wonder, you know, what in hindsight could have been done with that, because I think the potential of that kind of mass uprising was to some extent unrealized or dissipated into recalls within the Democratic Party.
Well, my view on it is we have to rebuild what I call a culture of organizing. When I was young in NSDS, everybody wanted to be an organizer. That was like, you know, your heroes, you know, the SNCC organizer, the campus organizers, the labor organizer, you know. But somewhere along the line, we stopped being organizers and we became activists. So now everybody's an activist, but nobody's an organizer. Everybody's for movements, but nobody's for building organizations. So to me, when I looked at Wisconsin and the upsurge here, I said, my God, what's wrong with these people? I said, if I was, you know, if I had the wherewithal and if I was in Wisconsin, I would be out in every single little town in the state building a grassroots workers' rights organization that was worked with Democrats but was independent of them. And I would build this organization to push the recall in every town. But I would do it, you know, independently so that when the battle was over, I had a group of 20 or 40 or 50 or 100 people who had an organization that they belonged to, that belonged to them, that they paid dues to. And then you would have something.
Yeah, and there is a group that's done a lot of work, United Wisconsin, that may still have the possibility of becoming that. I have this vision of local progressive councils, right, which is kind of a similar vision that you have. Let's talk about Obama in the last 5 minutes that we have. You were working with a group called Progressives for Obama.
Yes.
First time around. What's your evaluation of him?
The same as it was then. He's a liberal, corporate liberal speaking to the center. He represents a faction of imperialism, and I will give him a ballot over Romney. On the other hand, I understand exactly who he is and what he represents. I worked with him from day one. When I first met him when he was a young kid out of Project Vote. Me and 8-8 Corn Ladies interviewed him for the new party. I was thinking, this kid's really smart.
This was in Chicago?
In Chicago. I said, this kid's really smart. I says, if he plays his card right, he might get to be alderman someday. Little did I know. And then we, Marilyn Katz and I, set him up to give that first anti-war speech. But so I know Obama. I think his biggest weakness is he's a triangulator, but in a different way than Clinton. Clinton would take two fighting positions and then try to find a third position in between them and triangulate. Obama triangulates before the fight started.
Mm-hmm.
And that's his biggest weakness, I think. So I think Obama can be pushed, but in order to push him, you have to have something to push with. And it's not just a movement to push. You have to have organizational strength to push him. And if you haven't won that strength at the base, don't expect to have much clout at the top.
What do you say to people who, on the left, who think that Obama's been so bad that he doesn't deserve their vote, or they just won't vote for him because of either his war policies or his health care compromises or his civil liberties stuff, the National Defense Authorization Act, or assassinating people overseas? I mean, those are serious criticisms, and it's hard out of one corner of your mouth to criticize him all the time for that, and out of the other side say, okay, I'm going to vote for him anyway.
Well, I think I would repeat the story I told you earlier about the difference between politics as self-expression and politics as strategy. I think it's perfectly acceptable in my book to vote for a lesser evil as long as you tell the truth about them both. And so I wouldn't argue with any of the things that they're saying about Obama. Part of that is what it means to be president in a country that's still characterized as an imperialist power. I don't care who it is. They're going to have blood on their hands. And so the real question to me is, practically, what are the choices? The more important question is, what are you doing to organize at the base that's going to have it work for a different future? So you can work, I'm telling everybody, go out and defeat every Republican they can in this election and take down a few blue dogs, too, if they can. But the most important question is, what are you building at the base so that after this election is over, you have two or three times as many members in that local organization after the battle as you do before? Because that's the real measure of victory, not who occupies the White House. Because if you have that, then you have something you can push him with. Otherwise, the only thing you have is hot air. Doesn't amount to much.
And hot air, really, you can weigh that over and over again. It doesn't get you far. I'm speaking with Carl Davidson, a former leader of the SDS and national co-chair of the Committee of Correspondents for Democracy and Socialism. We've got only about 45 seconds left. You've been at this for 50 years now.
That's right. It amazed me. I was real looking at that sign they had for me on campus, the 50 years since Port Huron. I said, well, I wasn't at Port Huron, but 1962 was my first demonstration.
How do you keep going?
Cuban Missile Crisis. How do I keep going? It's, I don't know, it's just in my, after a while, it's in your bones. It's just the things that you do. You do it because it's the right thing to do.
And you've enjoyed the way?
Absolutely. It's been a bumpy ride at times, but I have no regrets.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today, Carl Davidson of the Committee of Correspondents for Democracy and Socialism. You can find out more about that group and find some of Carl Davidson's writings there at cc-ds.org. That's small cc-ds.org.
And my latest new project, if you want, is Online University of the Left. You can Google that and you'll find all sorts of things that will truly amaze you.
There we go.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.